returns to Foxwoods Resort Casino June 30th and July 1st. Nightmare on Elm Street fans meet Robert Englund. From Super Troopers 2, Eric Stolhansky. From Sons of Anarchy and Guardians of the Galaxy, Tommy Flanagan. From The Walking Dead and Avengers Infinity War, Ross Marquand. Comic book artists, KidsCon, cosplay contests, Ink Fusion Tattoo Pavilion, and more. All at Comic-Con. A show for the fans, by the fans, at Foxwoods Resort Casino. Buy tickets now at foxwoods.com and comicon.com.
The Undercover Capes Podcast Network proudly presents a series all about the amazing people behind the titles and characters we love. Welcome to Creator Spotlight.
Welcome everybody to another episode of Outside the Panels with me, Johnny the Machine Hughes. Today I am joined by a creator par excellence who has worked in various publishers across a very diverse story base. It is none other than Mr. Dark Ark, Mr. X-Men Blue, Mr. The Shadow, Cullen Bunn. Cullen, how are you?
I'm all right, John. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. So, thank you very much for taking time out of your absolutely hectic schedule to talk to me today. I really appreciate this. Should we start at the top and work our way down?
Sounds good.
All right, excellent. Okay, the question that everybody gets first of all is, how did you break into comics?
It's a long story. It took me a long time to break into comics. I think when I was trying to break in, I didn't really have any clue how to do it, and I don't think the resources were there, and I was living in the wrong part of the world to really facilitate it. I've always loved comics. I always wanted to tell stories, and so naturally I was trying to do some comic book stuff as well. And I was sending numerous pitches to Marvel and DC and pitching my very best stories and getting nowhere. I was getting form rejections, which, you know, is fine. It's the nature of the beast,
it's
so to speak.
It's part of the process, isn't it? It's how you earn your chops.
What I didn't realize is sending those pitches blindly to Marvel or DC, it just doesn't work for writers, and it still doesn't work for writers. But what ended up finally, you know, working for me is I was working at a comic book shop, and one of my coworkers was an aspiring artist. His name was Brian Hurt, and we started talking about doing a book together. And it took a couple of years to finally happen, but we did a book called The Damned, which we sent out to Oni Press, and they immediately snapped up that project and published it. And then a few years later, Brian and I did another book together called The Sixth Gun. And that book kind of got the attention of editors at Marvel and DC, and I was starting to get offers of more work from both of those publishers, and it just at the time this was happening, I was no longer at a comic book shop. It was years and years after the comic shop, but I was working in marketing, and I finally got to the point where I was getting enough work from both, you know, from all these different publishers, that I was able to start writing full time.
So I know your stuff predominantly from The Shadow and some of the independent stuff that you've worked on. Obviously, you're on Marvel, you're on X-Men Blue at the moment. What DC books have you done in the past?
Some of my first work outside of independent stuff was DC. An editor at DC named Will Moss sent me a tweet and asked me to contact him, and he offered me a four issue run on Superman Batman. So I did that was some of my first professional work. And then also for DC, though, over the years I've done – I did a pretty long run on Sinestro. Nice. I wrote Lobo. I wrote some Aquaman issues. I'm currently working on, I've written issues of Trinity. I'm currently, I just wrapped up a Suicide Squad annual. So I've done, you know, there was a time I was doing several books for DC. That's dialed back a little bit, but I still do a few here and there.
So again, another great character base, because, you know, you've talked about quite a range there, from Lobo to Sinestro. Don't let anybody on the Dynamic Crusade podcast hear you do Aquaman, because Aquaman's persona non grata on that show, I'm afraid. But
my Aquaman run was persona non grata among Aquaman fans, so it's
well, you're in good no company then, I guess. all right, okay, so. Who are your favorite creators? Who are your influences when you cast your mind back to your time you've spent in this wacky world of comic books?
You know, there's so many that I could name, but if I were going to really, really look back, Bill Mantlo, who in the 70s was writing so many books for Marvel, he wrote The Micronauts, he wrote Rom. I mean, he just wrote countless Marvel books. And then he also did some of his own stuff like Swords of the Swashbuckler and things like that. But he was a creator that I remember even as at a young age thinking that he was a real world builder. I mean, he took a book like Micronauts, which was based on a toy line, mm-hmm. and he made that book one of the, what I still consider one of the greatest, you know, science fiction space opera books. That has, you know, that's been published. So Bill Mantlo, Chris Claremont, Jim Starlin, those are all creators that that you know, when I was younger, definitely were a big influence on me. Warren Ellis and Grant Morrison, you know, in more recent times, those were big influences for me as well.
Cool, excellent. Have you checked out the new Micronauts and Rom series from IDW?
Well, I wrote the Micronaut series for IDW.
There is another occasion where my foot is planted firmly.
No. I wrote the original when IDW got the license. I wrote a few issues of that. I wrote like the first 11 or 12, and it wasn't as much fun as reading them. It's one of those things. I really wanted to write Micronauts, but I, you know, I don't. It's one of those things I could never capture what I loved about Micronauts. I think the run's just fine, but it's not. It wasn't in my mind. There was going to be this epic rebirth of the Micronauts, and it just I was never able to get that out of that series.
I think Micronauts and Rom suffer from Star Wars syndrome, in that when we look back, we think these were great for when we were the kids that enjoyed them. Now we're adults. Rom doesn't have the same level of panache as it did when we were kids, and Micronauts is the same kind of, and then Star Wars is a little bit tarnished because the films aren't aimed at us, they're aimed at the kids and stuff. But because we've got our rose-tinted glasses on, we kind of bypass that and say, why is this film for me? So I think that kind of plays a little bit into that. I've read a few of the Rom books, and I've found them a little bit, I'm not going to say dissatisfying, because it's Rom and the whole idea of Rom really worked back in Marvel, but nowhere near as enjoyable as you said Mantlo's run.
Well, and like I said, a lot of that goes to Bill Mantlo, because he took, again, these toy lines that, you know, this was both Rom and Micronauts back in those days were not books that had, pre-existing storylines. Most toys, you know, in recent years, they have a storyline built in and maybe a cartoon coming out and everything else. But those toy lines didn't have those storylines. They had nothing except the toys themselves. And Mantlo just kind of built up these really rich worlds for both of those properties.
I can definitely see, I totally agree with you on the Rom. We had Micronauts over here, but I didn't see the Rom robot anywhere over here when I was a kid, so
it was kind of a terrible toy. It was kind of, he kind of fell apart a lot, his legs kept falling off, and all he really did, he was sort of like a magic eight ball. You could press a button on his back and he would either he would bong like one time or two times or three times. So you could ask him questions and he would bong to answer your questions, I guess. Yes, no, or maybe.
Rob, is my father a diarrhea? Bong.
Right, bong, yeah.
Okay, so as alluded to, you've worked on a number of books. I loved your shadow stuff. I mentioned it a couple of times. How do you maintain that level of flexibility? Because it kind of, each book has its own voice. How do you manage to successfully go from sort of like Lobo to Sinestro to The Shadow to X-Men to Dark Ark?
Well, I think sometimes it's easier than others. First of all, I'm a fan of most of these things. If it's a property that, like The Shadow, for instance, I wanted to do The Shadow because I've always loved The Shadow. I was a fan. I wanted to, and I've spent time reading these stories, listening to the radio show, you know, things like that with The Shadow. So I wanted to really capture that voice. And the same goes for all these other books I do. You know, if it's a creator owned book, the voice for those tend to come a little more easily. If it's a character that someone else owns, I might, before I get started on a project, I might read some books about that character, or, you know, read books that are in that vein or have the feel of what I want. And that kind of, you know, it resets my mind for, you know, the different projects.
Okay. Before we move on to your current project, one more question about mainstream before we move forward a little bit.
Sure.
X-Men Blue, and X-Men generally, I was in a local comic book, my local comic book shop, and I was talking, shooting the breeze about what sells and what doesn't and so on. And the guy behind the counter says, we only stock 5 issues of X-Men every time it comes in. And even then, some of them don't get sold. And I'm thinking, wow, when I was collecting, like, back in the 90s and the early 80s, X-books were, like, flying off the shelf. You couldn't get them for love nor money. And now, currently, the X-Men are kind of a little bit cast aside from the Marvel Universe. How do you feel with working on X-Men Blue? You've got the original cast, plus a couple of extra members kicking around. So how do you feel at the X-Men's place in the Marvel Universe? Are you happy? Does it frustrate you? Does it kind of like think, am I going to get renumbered anytime soon and get the whole full court Marvel reboot press?
Well, you know, it's... I don't know that it's just X-Men either. I think, you look at sales from, say, the early 90s when I was working in a comic shop, and sales now, it can look drastically different, and there's a different level of excitement. Mm-hmm. And I think comics just in general, it is frustrating because I try to figure out what is it that's going to make a comic a hit. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult because I think a lot of times, mainstream readers are not as open to new titles or new books, but they're really not that open to some of the old existing stuff either. You know, it's frustrating. But I kind of get it. I mean, I get where people are coming from. These books are expensive now. They're not, you know, comics aren't cheap. It's not a cheap hobby. And you have to be in it for the love of it. But I think the problem is the people who are really in love with these titles are still buying books. I don't know what format they're buying them in. Maybe nowadays they're buying them in trade or they're buying them digitally. They're still buying it. But it's getting new readers in that really makes a difference. And every store is different. You know, my store that I go to stocks at least 50 issues of every X-Men Blue, and they don't keep, you know, it can be different for the different client, you know, different clienteles. It can be different based on who's running the store. Uh-huh. I mean, if a retailer doesn't like a certain book, that book's not going to sell for that retailer. There's just no way it's going to happen.
I agree totally on that.
And that's fine. And again, that's fine too. But so it's hard for me to say why a book might not sell there. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started writing X-Men, you know, years ago, there was always this, this idea that Marvel didn't like the X-Men, or Marvel wasn't putting anything behind the X-Men because they didn't own the media rights or whatever. And I can tell you that was a really weird conspiracy theory that a lot of people really bought into. But working behind the scenes, I never saw that. I was never told, you know, anything like that. None of that really impacted us as we were writing the books. So who knows? You know, I go back and forth. Does renumbering really help comics? As a collector, I don't like it. But as a reader, I don't like it. But I know that whenever a comic book company puts a new number one out, that book sells more. So, I mean, it's weird. We hear complaints about it all the time, and yet that's the kind of stuff that sells. Same with events. We hear, you know, we don't like events. No more big events. And I can tell you that I sat at a comic book shop one day at a signing, and a guy came in, and he just started ranting about events almost as soon as he walked through the door, how he hates events and how events are the worst thing to ever happen to comics. And I said to him, well, I've got a book for you, sir, because this book, The Sixth Gun, ties into nothing. It's its own story, and you don't have to read anything else. You don't have to read a bunch of tie-ins you don't want to buy. You can read The Sixth Gun and enjoy it just for The Sixth Gun. And he did not buy The Sixth Gun. And as he was leaving, he had a stack of maybe 20 books. And I said, hey, can I see what books you got there? And he showed me his books, and every single copy of what he bought that day was an event tie-in. It was all an event book. So it's difficult for me to kind of, you know, first of all, I'm not the person to solve this problem, but it's difficult for me to figure out if people don't like events and yet that's the only book they buy. Where does that, you know, what does that mean? All I could do to try to make it, you know, to try to get people to read books is I, you know, can tell the best story I can within, if there are guidelines that I have to work within, then within those guidelines. But, you know, the best I can do is try to tell the best story I can, and artists try to draw the best story they can. And that's all we can do. But it is frustrating that X-Men, which when I was growing up was, like you said, one of the biggest, you know, the biggest books around, and it's not anymore. But it's not just X-Men. I think there's a lot of books that there's so many books that I think should do so much better, you know. mine and others. So
yeah, I was just kind of, I picked it up because obviously, you know, with you working on Xbox and that sort of universe is kind of taken a, even within the bigger frame of the Marvel universe, seems smaller somehow. And I mean, Marvel have had the Fantastic Four conspiracy. They're gone now. They're coming back, and so on and so forth. You've got two Jean Greys kicking around at the moment. You've got Scott Summers that may or may not turn out to be the same Scott Summers who did what he did in Civil. So it just goes nuts, doesn't it? How things can I guess be circular. I think.
Well, and you know, that's a good point too. Is I do think that right now I think the storyline is kind of twisted and convoluted on a lot of these. You know, you just describing it to me, and I write these, you know, the original five X-Men. And I'm like, man, that's complicated. Yeah, I'm like,
really?
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, exactly. And you know, and there are arguments to, is the brand diluted? You know, again, X-Men was a super big comic when there was one, you know, when there was Uncanny X-Men.
Brilliant, yeah.
And then there, you know, then there was X-Men and Uncanny X-Men, and that was a big deal. But then there became, you know, X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, X-Force, you know, Astonishing X-Men.
X-Factor.
You know, so there's some question of that. Is the brand diluted? But at the same time, you know, there are stories that are these stories people want to read. You know, you can't. There are how many X-Men characters now? You know, who knows? Hundreds. So they won't all. Yeah, they won't all fit in one book, unfortunately.
That's true.
I have long pitched an X-Men series that would feature essentially over time every X character would get some, you know, every character in the X-Men universe would get some play, but it would be a long running book that probably would never, ever happen, you know.
Just let me know which issue Arcade's in, because I think he's class. That's a blast from the past.
Yes.
Okay, cool. So, mainstream out of the way. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty. You have a Kickstarter coming out, or if not, it's out now, and people can contribute for it. And this is, of course, Metro, a very dark urban fantasy.
Metro is a book that I'm doing with a couple of guys. My co-writer on the project is Brian Quinn. Is known, most people know him from a TV show called The Impractical Jokers.
We get that over here. We're all right.
Yeah, which is, it's a pretty funny show about a bunch of, you know, yahoos playing jokes on, practical jokes on each other. A few years ago, I met him through comics. Brian is a huge comic book fan. And when my Lobo series was announced at DC, I remember he sent me some messages, kind of, you know, giving me trouble about this version of Lobo that I was writing. It was good natured. It was not hate. It was just a good natured ribbing, because it was a different version of Lobo than what his favorite was. But from that, we kind of struck up a friendship, and we started talking a lot about comics and eventually, you know, I just asked him if he was interested in doing a comic, writing something. And he was very interested in it. We kicked a few ideas around, and from that, Metro came about. And Metro was a book, the overall concept is something he had been toying with for decades. And so we started, you know, developing it as a script. And Brian, in addition to being on the show Impractical Jokers, is also on a podcast called Tell 'Em Steve Dave, that's very popular. And one of his co-hosts on that podcast is a guy named Walt Flanagan. Mm-hmm. Walt is an artist on books like Batman, The Widening Gyre, and he's also on a TV show called Comic Book Men on AMC. And since he was good friends with Brian, we talked to him about drawing the book, and he, you know, came on board as our artist and co-creator on the project.
Cool. Excellent. So you're such a recognizable name from all your work in the past. Walt Flanagan has published comic books in the past, as you mentioned, and Brian Quinn, maybe not recognized as a comic book writer, but obviously a talented guy, a talented bloke, as we see over here in the UK.
And a lot of his fans too pick up on that he's a comic book fan, so he's drawn in comic book fans because they share that interest, I guess.
Brilliant. So he's like one of us.
Right.
Kind of thing. So with all that talent and all that brand, that instant recognizable name stuff going on, question is, why do you need a Kickstarter?
That's a good question. And when we set out to do this book, that wasn't our original plan. But as we started talking to publishers about the book, you know, as you said earlier, it's a very dark book. And honestly, we scared a couple of publishers off right away. They were not willing to publish the book, or weren't interested in publishing the book, because, quite frankly, even within the first few pages, I mean, some really horrible stuff happens.
You're talking about the corpus interruptus.
Yeah. Right. And I think that, honestly, I think that troubled a few publishers. We did have a lot of publishers who wanted to do the book. Uh-huh. But one of the things we found is a few publishers actually wanted to run Kickstarters themselves for it. Right. And I think you're going to start seeing more of that in the years to come is publishers running Kickstarters for their projects.
There's a couple kicking about now, pardon to use the bad English, but Dynamite have got something running.
Yeah.
One of their side projects featuring, yeah, Red Sonja. And you think to yourself, well, hold on a second, that's Dynamite and Red Sonja. Those two are synonymous for like years now. Why do they need a Kickstarter? Why do they need to fund money for a project which they should be able to just put straight out there?
Well, you know, and I don't hold it against them for doing it, but as we started talking to publishers about it, who would have a say in the editorial of the book and may want to change what we wanted to do, and may take, you know, piece of ownership of the project. We just started to think, you know, why not just do it ourselves? You know, we know that the fan base is out there. We know we would be able to attract a fan base on the project. And we maintain complete control over everything. I have wanted to do Kickstarter projects for a long time now, and I kept holding off on doing it. So this is my first Kickstarter, but it's the first of many, because and I'm not talking about things with Brian and Walt, although we will do more Kickstarters, I'm sure. You know, but I would like to run 3 or 4 Kickstarters a year for different projects. You know, one of the exciting things to me about Kickstarter is, and I don't want, you know, this is not saying anything against a publisher, because I, you know, I'm very grateful to the people who publish my work and the people who will continue to publish my work. And I will continue to do projects with those, you know, with those publishers.
Of course.
Yeah. But I can't do everything, you know, everything I want to do doesn't necessarily fit into the model of the publishers that are out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, Metro's one type of book, but, you know, what if I want to do just a book that's a 60-page oversized comic book issue?
Yeah.
That's something that is better suited to Kickstarter. And I'm going to look at, you know, I'm going to look at that, and I'm going to look at, you know, doing some different kinds of things, bringing in some new voices. You know, one of the next projects I'll be doing is an anthology of horror stories that is based. All the stories are based on my work, on my short fiction, but they are going to be adapted by creators that don't have a huge voice right now, who may not have, some of them are unpublished, and it's going to be adapted by a number of different creators so that I can bring new voices out there and give them a platform to start telling stories. And that's rewarding in a completely different way for me than a book. You know, Metro's rewarding because we're doing exactly what we want to do, mm-hmm. and we're bringing it to the fans. And another reason Metro, I think, is great for Kickstarter is fans of Walt and Brian, some of them aren't comic book fans. Mm-hmm. They're not going to go to the comic shop and pre-order Metro, mm-hmm. and come back 2 months later and pick it up. It's not in their schedule. It doesn't work for them. But what it does do, you know, with Metro, they can go in, they can support it. They know exactly where they go to get it, and they'll get the book, and they're, you know, they'll get a great book from their, you know, from these creators that they enjoy.
Excellent. So the whole idea of creating or giving new voices a chance to work on your short stories previously, are you creating a Bun universe the way that Mike Mignola created pretty much the Horrorverse for Dark Horse? Is that your overall?
I don't know if it's a new universe. I do love creating, you know, worlds and creating universes. You know, Metro, for instance, is a big world. And Brian and I are already, you know, at the close of this campaign, when we're done with Metro, when the campaign's fully funded and everything, we're going to kind of let the people who've backed us, we'll tell them what's next in the world of Metro, because Metro is a bigger project. It's a big world. And one of the things I love about it is that we're going to, you know, be expanding on that world. The other stuff, some of it will fit within a shared unit, maybe sort of a loosely shared universe. Uh-huh. But I don't know that that's at least not initially. That's not what with that other project. That's not what I'm trying to do. Although, you know, who knows? Maybe.
Yeah, cards. Who knows where they fall right now?
So, that's right.
So, is horror a new venture for you then? Because obviously people will know your stuff from the mainstream as much as anything else. Dark Ark, which I can't say too often because my tongue gets tied up. Dark Ark was kind of, I guess, my first introduction to the darker side of your writing.
Yes.
So both me and my stepson, Stephen, we both loved the book. And he was pestering me all the time. He's like, when's the number 2 coming out? When's the number 3 coming out? I'm like, it's coming out, don't worry, it's fine. Yeah. So we both loved that. So is horror like has it always been kind of on the back burner for you whilst you've been doing like the more generic superhero stuff? Or is it something that you've just kind of come into recently?
No, it's writing horror stories and dark stories has always been that. If we're going to say this is my, you know, a book that's in my wheelhouse, mm-hmm. dark comics and horror comics have always been in my wheelhouse. That's the kind of stuff I enjoy writing. My first project, published work, was a horror themed, mobster story called The Damned. The Sixth Gun, which is more of a fantasy, but it has a lot of horror elements in it as well. And most of my creator owned stuff, not all of it, but most of my creator owned stuff, falls into dark fantasy or horror. And in all honesty, I think a lot of the superhero stuff that I think is best regarded, falls into that as well. Like Sinestro for DC was absolutely a horror story set in space. And Magneto, a book I did for Marvel, which was is very well regarded, a book I'm very proud of. I wrote that book going in saying I want to write a horror story with Magneto as the star, and that's really what we did with that series. And I think even in a book like X-Men Blue, which is lighter, more lighthearted, I definitely put some horror story, horror elements in some of the issues, and I continue to go back to that over and over again.
So Metro, we've spoken that some of the ideas of the Metro kind of gave editors kittens. a couple of scenes early on in the book. I've read the first chapter, and I've reviewed it on Geekery magazine. And horror isn't my normal cup of tea. I'll say that straight out. But I enjoyed it. I thought that the writing was really good, and I liked the art. The art kind of had like a Vertigo Steve Dillon type feel.
Sure.
I mean? From some of those like Hellblazer books back from when. I quite like that. There were a couple of things going on that was kind of like, ooh, does that mean this? And does that mean something else? I'm not going to go into it. No spoilers here. If you want spoilers, go and check somewhere else, because you're not going to get them here. that's half our listeners just cut off right now.
Right, they all shut down.
Yeah, there might be spoilers later. That'll bring them back. So I also liked the bad guys.
Yeah.
They very much had the Wild Eye Three. Yeah.
The Wide Eye Three.
Sorry. And it reminded me so much of like an adult version of the Demon Three from DC.
I don't think there's any. So first of all, you said Wild Eye Three, and just so you know. It's funny. I used to say Wild-Eyed 3 all the time in writing the scripts for the first few issues. And Brian would come back and correct me and say, you know what is? He said, you know, I think they're the Wide-Eyed 3, but if you want them to be the Wild-Eyed 3, then that's fine. So I think they're fun characters. I don't know. I'd have to ask Brian if he pulled any inspiration from the Demon, the Demon 3. I don't think so, but maybe. He created those characters. Those are characters that have been in his head, which bothers me that those three characters would be in anybody's head. He had the initial concept for them, and then we took them and kind of developed them out into what they are on the page. Maybe. And they're horrible. I mean, they are ghastly, ghastly villains. And I think. I'm speaking for Brian here, but I think he'd quickly say they are some of his favorite characters. I mean, he loves those characters so much.
Maybe they're an analogy of his Impractical Joker colleagues.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they are really vicious conspiracy theorists who maybe their theories may be right. But they are so disturbing that no one would ever listen to them.
Because you mentioned how certain elements of the book kind of got into the skin of people. Sadly to say, the first few pages weren't the thing that disturbed me. It was very much the interaction of the Wide-Eyed Three that kind of was like, what? So that brings up an interesting question. How does the writing work between yourself and Brian? Is one kind of like dialogue guy and one kind of like script?
No.
It's more organic than that.
It's a little you know, it's not what you just described. So what we do is we talk about what's going to happen in, I think, well, with Metro, we talked about what was going to happen in, you know, the first five chapters. Originally, we were planning it as issues. So the first five issues. And we talked about that right up front. And then I kind of worked up an outline for each issue, breaking it down page by page. And it would say, you know, on this page, these are the things that we need to happen, you know, and it was very broad strokes.
So you're
and
kind of then, like the person guy at that point.
Well, and even then, maybe a little bit. Yeah, we take the idea and I'd say this is, you know, I'd kind of do a quick outline, very broad strokes. And then I would take that outline and I would break it up and I would say, okay, Brian, you write, Brian loved to write the wide-eyed three pages. So I'd always try to give him more wide-eyed three if I could. We'd break it up, you know, Brian might write pages 1 through 3 and I would do 4 through 7 and then he would write 8, 9, 10, and 11 and we'd break it up that way. And then we'd take the different pages that we'd written and we put them all together and we kind of smooth the edges so that it worked and it would flow together very well. But every issue, you know, I have written books in the past where co-writing is just it is not the right term. It's basically I write every word, but with this project, absolutely, we split the writing course pretty much right down the middle. And Brian, you know, he would get on a tear of writing, you know, certain sections, and he'd come back and say, "I know I was only supposed to write 4 pages in this section, but I went ahead and wrote, there's 8 in here." So we would have to, you know, expand that chapter a little bit, which is fine, especially with the way we ended up deciding to publish it. We had more freedom to, you know, to play with it instead of being constrained by, you know, the number of pages in an issue.
Yeah. So you're not constrained by page number, brand, or
right,
any sort of constriction from an editor that turns around and says, you can't do this, you can't do that.
Right.
Yeah.
And Metro is absolutely a book that any good editor had a publisher who has, you know, to represent the publisher's interest is going to come back and tell us, oh, you can't do that in a comic. You know, please, you know, you that can't be done. Because, you know, like I said, it's an unapologetic comic. It's it has a lot of very uncomfortable things in it. The wide-eyed three are vicious and mean. The world itself is vicious and mean, and we, you know, we don't sugarcoat that aspect of it. We're not. It's not a, like I said, it's not a book for the faint of heart.
Yeah, you don't pull any punches. It's a mature book. It's, from
it's yeah, probably, absolutely.
Probably
yeah.
One of the most mature books I've read in a while. People who check this book out need to be aware of that. That said,
yes, please don't give it to your kids.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Don't do that. my next question, it kind of links in with the vibe of Metro. Publishers that were kind of interested, did you think about going Aftershock? Because I think Aftershock are probably the ones that kind of have that sort of open mentality, or has that changed over the last couple of years? Because when they first started, they were kind of like going, like Insects, for example. Insects is a great example of how far you can take an idea and then just run with it to all sorts of crazy.
Yeah,
it's a little bit. Maybe it has, but the initial hook was really interesting.
Yeah, I don't, you know, Aftershock was definitely on the list. We didn't take the book to Aftershock. That's not a publisher we talked to, although we did consider it. One of the reasons I hedged from that early on was because I was developing so many different books with them. And I didn't want to have, you know, it goes back to some of what I said earlier. Is Aftershock can't publish everything I do. And I've kind of carved out a certain kind of feel for Aftershock books that have come out for me so far. I've done Dark Ark, and I've done Unholy Grail, and I've done I'm currently doing Brothers Dracul, and they all have sort of a fantasy element to it, and maybe that's what I'm gonna stick with my Aftershock books. I kind of like that they all have that shared fantasy realm, and Metro, while it is a fantasy, huge departure in tone and setting and everything else from all the, from those three other Aftershock books. So, and I love the guys at Aftershock. I think you're absolutely right. They do books that other people would not, you know, and they're willing to really stretch, you know, stretch their muscles. But we did not take Metro to Aftershock. Okay. And the reason mainly was I was already developing three books, four book, you know, I'm going to definitely be doing more books with them too. So.
All right, that's cool. So you mentioned about how editors would kind of balk at some of the things. You can't do that, or that.
What happens
then? How's the decision-making process work between the three of you? Because obviously Walt Flanagan's involved from the artistic element. So you've got Walt, you've got yourself, and you've got Brian. How do you hash out any sort of editorial decisions that would normally fall within the remit of the editor?
Yeah, and we've only really gotten into that a couple of times where we had sort of an overarching disagreement's too strong of a word, but just a discussion of how we should do something.
See, that's what I say to my wife.
Yeah.
Me and Mrs. Hughes, Mrs. H, we discuss things. We don't argue, we discuss.
Yeah. And you know, it just comes down to, I think the three of us, we have a respect for one another, and while we may disagree on things, I think we can come to a good solution. I think, you know, I don't think there's any problem with me sharing the story because it shows how it's I think it's very it illustrates how we did, you know, do solve these kind of things. Last year at San Diego Comic-Con, we decided we were going to sort of stealth release this preview edition of Metro. It's, I don't know, 6 pages of art and a few, you know, a few articles about the book and where it came from and things like that. And we worked out with a vendor in Comic-Con to let Brian and myself, do a signing and give these preview editions away for free. And as we were putting them together, Walt came back to us and he said, "Guys, I'm really worried about this book. I'm worried that people are going to read it and publishers are going to start firing Cullen because it's so vicious and mean and cruel." And he was worried about my career in comics. He's like, "Man, I just don't want, you know, some editor to read this and say, we can't hire Cullen Bunn anymore because he wrote, you know, this ghastly comic book." And we talked a lot about it. You know, I don't think that's ever something that I'm concerned about. You know, I'm not going to hedge away from something disturbing in a horror comic. Mm-hmm. And you know, but we went back and forth, and I offered. I said, "Well, maybe we'll just preview different pages from the comic," and we talked about that, and that was an option. And we were getting down to the wire because we really had to get them to the printer if we were going to have them in time for San Diego. And what we ended up, Brian came back and said, "I've got an idea. I've got a brainstorm. Why don't we release the preview, but we put censorship boxes all throughout it so that we're covering up everything that's horrible?" And we put. So we ended up, the preview edition has all these pages that are like, you can't show that at Comic-Con. And, you know, nobody in their right mind would, you know, write this into a comic. And there's all these great little censorship boxes all throughout the preview edition, which gives it its own feel. And it was perfect it was a perfect feel for what Metro's all about. Uh-huh. And kind of, you know, it kind of straddled the idea of humor and horror mixing. And it was just perfect for that. And that was how we, you know, we talked that all out and finally got to a conclusion that we all liked. And that's really what we do, you know, in any situation, you know.
Cool. Great story. Excellent. One time that the censorship boxes actually helped the comic book.
That's right. And now that I've said that, I'm going to put those censored pages up on our Kickstarter just as an update to say, look what we, you know, just as that, share that story with people. Cause I think it's a fun story and it's a fun way of how we got around it.
Excellent. You mentioned about the humor in the book. There is, There is humour. Aptly, it's dark humour. towards the end, there's some violence going on. It seems to be a little bit slapstick in nature. Was that by means to try and de-violence the violence?
Yeah, you know, it was sort of a, I would call it a whistling past the graveyard kind of thing, where, you know, there's these horrible things going on, so let's put some humor into it. And the humor's pretty horrible, too, at times, but let's put some humor into it so that it's just not so oppressive. I think without the humor, it would easily be just too, you know, it would be like an encumbrance on your shoulders as you read this thing because it's just so dark. Yeah, so the humor kind of hedges us, allows us to get away with some of it. And, you know, they're telling, you know, there's jokes and humor going on. And some of the violence is so over the top that it itself is sort of sickeningly humorous. You know, it's not meant to be our world. It's sort of an exaggerated version of our world and a more disturbing version of our world.
And that's a great way of putting it, because the darkness is exaggerated. The horror is exaggerated. The humor is exaggerated. It's kind of taking those key elements and stretching it a little bit to make it darker in its own little way.
I've always thought of it as sort of I do this in other comics too, not necessarily for, you know, this the violence or whatever, but it's sort of an absurdist approach to the horror. Yeah. And that's exactly what we were going for with Metro, is this sort of absurd. I mean, it's not a, the storyline is serious. The story is serious, and it has sort of a, you know, this dark fantasy vibe to it, and there's a bigger story that's unfolding. But we, you know, there are moments of sort of just pure absurdity that's going on in the comic.
Okay, cool. Well, I kind of the absurdity element a little bit. I've fallen back in love. You know, you talk about Rom and the Micronauts. Fallen back in love with Airwolf. You know, the
TV. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's on reruns at the moment. And the other day, I must have watched like 3 back to back. And I was thinking to myself, at no point does anybody say that civilian pilots just killed 300 people out of the sky.
Right.
Yeah. And the A-team, it, like, stuff blew up and the guys crawled out of the truck so to make sure no one got hurt. Airwolf, he's killing everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And there's like that. And it's totally different cup of tea, a totally different thing. But reading Metro, the horror and the darkness reminded me, out of context, of Airwolf, thinking there's this guy just flying around the sky, killing loads of people with no remorse, no ramifications, no nothing. He's just blowing people out of the sky. And then I read this, and it's like all the other stuff that goes on. I was like, man. You know, the absurdity of it all just kind of like bounced in my head for a little bit. So,
well, I will say that this is the first. I would never have expected anyone to correlate Airwolf with Metro, but okay, I'll take it. That's fine. I'll also say, you know, a few years back, Lion Forge Comics had the license to Airwolf, and they were wanting to do an Airwolf comic, and I pitched them. The idea I pitched them was. Let's do Airwolf. It's modern day, and technology has already outdistanced what was in that TV show. You know, in the TV show, Airwolf was like state of the art, you know, bleeding edge, impossible technology in a helicopter. And now, you know, what we actually have in reality is far more advanced than what was in that show. And I said, well, let's revamp it, and it's set in modern day. But the helicopter hasn't been advanced. It's the same helicopter's been sitting in mothballs for all these years. And now for whatever reason, they have to bring it out of mothballs. And it's just so far behind every other helicopter that's out there. But the pilots have to make it work and go on these crazy adventures. They didn't take me up on that one. But that's the idea I liked about Air. That's the idea I like for Airwolf.
It would never work in a comic book shop, Airwolf. Unless, of course, one panel you had the guns out, then in the very next panel the guns were in. The amount of bad bad editing in that show just makes me cringe. When I was a kid, I loved it. Now I look at it, I go, why are the two pilots? Where's the other pilot gone? What? But never mind. Back to comics. We'll get there. How was Walt Flanagan to work with? Was he very vociferous with the art? Did he take direction, or did you just let him say, right, this is what we want to do, knock your socks off?
Yeah, we write a full script for the entire thing. But really Walt has freedom to expand on that and change things around. And he kind of went crazy on these pages. but he's great to work with, and like I said, he just makes it a lot of fun. I think the book's a lot of fun to look at. And all credit to him for that. He took our script and brought it to life. But yes, he had plenty of freedom. In fact, I remember most of the pages Brian wrote, there's a little like disclaimer at the top of each page. Walt, this is how I see it, but please do your own thing here. I remember it just struck me that every, you know, I think almost all his pages say, Walt, do your own thing, you know, but this is how I see it. And sometimes he did what Brian, you know, he followed Brian's guidance, and sometimes he did do his own thing. But it didn't change the story. It just kind of enhanced the visuals of those moments.
Cool. Excellent. So we mentioned the Kickstarter is in place at the moment.
Yes.
You're doing very well, it seems.
We've blown past our first two stretch goals. We're heading towards our next stretch goal. So it's been very well received.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So on the Kickstarter, for those that want to check it out, go to kickstarter.com, type in Metro, a very dark urban fantasy graphic novel. The page will come up, and there's videos from yourself, from Brian, as well as a little video about the book itself.
Yeah, we've got some videos up there, some messages from the team. If you check out the updates, we've got more messages from the team, and we've got lots of pages of art so that you can see what the book looks like. The exciting thing about this for me is a lot of times you can back Kickstarters, and I back a ton of Kickstarters. I like the platform. I love it for comics, and now it's kind of expanded beyond comics for me into, you know, games and clothing. I mean, I'm backpacks. I back just so many different weird things on Kickstarter, just because I'm just fascinated by this by the nature of creation that kind of surrounds it. And one of the things though is sometimes you have to wait a long time for these projects to be completed. But with Metro, it's done. I mean, all of the art assets are complete with Metro, so we're going to fulfill very quickly after the campaign closes. I mean, there's some things we have to do because we're adding in like thank you pages and things like that will have to be designed after the campaign closes. But you won't have to wait for Walt to finish drawing the book because it's done. You know, you won't have to wait for the colors to come in because they're done. So that's I think there's a people who back this project should have a sense of comfort in that they're definitely going to get the book because it's, you know, you're not going to have to wait forever for this work to be completed. We didn't launch the Kickstarter until we were done with all the art assets.
Okay. Now, my boss on Comic Crusaders, Al Mega, he every time we talk about Kickstarter, he talks about a certain comic book creator who created Image and he's still waiting for some Brigade stuff or something or other from Mr. Rob Liefeld. Every time we talk about it, he says, oh man, I've put my 5 books in, I haven't got this, I haven't got that, thank God bless. But it's good for people who are just checking out Kickstarters to hear that the work's done, back the book, and they get the rewards, and of course they get the book as well. Great.
Yeah, I think it's we've got some exciting reward levels, exciting editions of the book. We're working, we decided to work with some people who are experts in fulfilling these projects, so we didn't want to have to deal with mailing them out ourselves personally. I didn't want, tons of these books in my living room. I wanted to. So we've got fulfillment companies ready to go. People who are great with with getting the books distributed to where they need to be and making sure all the trains get where they're going on time. So, you know, I think we're doing it's interesting for me as a first Kickstarter project. It's awesome because this is how a Kickstarter should be run, in my opinion. And there's some, you know, we're incurring some additional expenses because we're hiring people that know what they're doing. Yeah. I think it's worth it though. And I think in the end, our the readers are going to be so much happier because they're going to get things so smoothly. And I think it's going to be an exciting project for everybody.
I like the way that the Kickstarter ships anywhere around the world. So you've got fans obviously across America and the UK as well as other places. People can pledge the money and they're going to get the graphic or the trade when it comes out. And
yes. Yeah. And that's another reason we wanted to hire people to help us with it. Because I was sitting there I was beating my head against the wall. I was like, oh my gosh, how do you figure out shipping to, you know, all over the world? And the people we're working with was like, you don't worry about it. We know how to do that. We'll take care of that for you. So it's nice to work with people who know what they're doing for sure.
All right. That's about it. Thank you very much, Cullen, for taking time out of your schedule to talk to me about Metro. For those that are interested, check out the Kickstarter. Shared loads of information on there. Also, the first chapter has had two spoiler-free reviews, one on Comic Crusaders and one on Geekly Magazine. Check them out for more information. Cullen, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
I have absolutely loved our chat, and I've loved a lot of your work from previous books, as I mentioned at the start. I think Metro is going to be a great book for people who enjoy the genre, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. So once again, thank you very much, Cullen.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Excellent. Okay, guys, that's it for a wrap. Don't forget to check out the UCPM for all your favorite podcast shows, including the Definitive Crusade and No Price Podcast. See you later. Bye.
Visit UndercoverCapes.com for the latest and greatest podcasts via the Undercover Capes Podcast Network. Also visit our parent company website, ComicCrusaders.com, all about comic pop culture.